Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. This is Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. We're going to start off the Wednesday show with a discussion about the ongoing attempted coup d'etat at the nation's capital.
And then we'll have an interview with investigative reporter Greg Pellast about voter suppression in Georgia.
Then we talk with Greta Zaro of World Beyond War.
And later on, we hear from Assembly Member John McDonald.
After that, Troy organizers and indigenous groups are working to save Troy's last waterfront from being turned into an apartment complex. But first, headlines.
Supporters of Donald Trump stormed the nation's capital today following Trump's speech at a rally, urging them to reject the results of the recent election. The certification of the Electoral College results, already being impeded by numerous Republican legislators, including local Congress member Elaine
Stefanik.
Thank you. Elaine Stefanik was suspended as the police security at the Capitol fell apart. Virginia has sent their National Guard to help restore order, and we will discuss more of this after the headlines.
Throughout New York, county officials are continuing to push back against Governor Cuomo's plan to use hospitals to coordinate the distribution of the COVID vaccine. The process appears to be in disarray, with approximately 300,000 New Yorkers vaccinated out of 19 million so far. Counties want to instead use their long-standing plans developed on how to distribute vaccines for flu.
Schenectady school officials are asking parents and guardians of children in the district to sign consent forms ahead of possible in-school testing for coronavirus. School districts across the Capital Region are preparing to begin school-based COVID-19 testing, but local school and health officials are still awaiting clarification from state officials. Governor Cuomo on Monday suggested school districts in counties with test positivity rates should above 9%, which includes much of the Capital Region, would be required to test a portion of its students and staff.
Democrats have won the two open United States Senate seats in Georgia, with the second seat actually being called as Congress members ran for cover at the takeover at the Capitol. This means the Democrats will control both houses of Congress as well as the White House. Senator Chuck Schumer of Brooklyn will become the Senate Majority Leader.
And Saratoga County's Police Reform Committee is inviting the public to participate in its next meeting at 6 p.m. Thursday, January 7th. The Zoom call is designed to comply with Governor Andrew Cuomo's order to end bias in police policies and practices. The County Board of Supervisors must act on the recommendation by April the 1st.
The Time Union reports that Troy city officials hope that a proposed $50 million investment in the historic Standard Manufacturing Building at 2nd Avenue and 120th Street to create 151 units of affordable housing will provide a much-needed economic boost to Landsberg.
Then the Daily Gazette reports that two young Democrats who have never run for office are applying to fill the two pending vacancies on the Schenectady City Council. Brendan Savage, a 21-year-old Siena College student whose mother is the former head of the Schenectady County Legislature, and Carl Williams, who's 31, vice chairman of Schenectady's Civilian Police Review Board. They're both candidates for the council seat being given up by Ed Cossier and Lisa Parisio, who are resigning.
It's been more than 3 months since Troy City Council approved the contract for Police One body cameras, and nearly 1 month since those cameras were delivered. But city leaders say they are still negotiating policy on the use of the equipment. The police union says they are ready to sign, but are waiting on the mayor. And that concludes our headlines. But on Wednesday, the nation was gripped as Congress began what was normally a routine process of certifying the election results from the Electoral College. Remember, it's the Electoral College rather than the American people who get to vote for president. Now, the Electoral College activity, the Republicans, including 11 senators and maybe 100 Congress members, had decided to make this a big fight, and they were planning to drag it out for hours. The president had repeatedly asserted that the vice president had the power under the Constitution to just ignore the Electoral College and pick whoever he wanted. Pence, who actually is an attorney, repeatedly told the president that was not the case. Mid-morning on Wednesday, the president addressed a crowd of maybe 10,000 or so supporters out in front of the White House and urged them to go over to the Congress to protest. And they cook him up on his word and somehow managed to circumvent or evade the police presence out in front of Congress and managed to break windows and break doors and get into the United States Congress. And they had to shut down the certification. People fled out of fear for their lives. The Secret Service particularly grabbed Pence, since Pence had been made a target by Trump at the rally earlier in the day. And they, you know, they rushed Pence to safety. There were certainly efforts to also make sure that Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, and the leadership of the Senate was also secured.
I think also Camilla was also taken in.
The vice president is also president. Yes. Now, I understand you have some of the headlines. I know that New York State legislative leaders basically have spoken out calling it treason. Speaker Carl Hastie said in a statement, this is domestic terrorism and is an attempt to overthrow the elected will of the American people. And Assembly Member Pat Fahey, who represents Albany County, said that the chaos and insurrection at the United States Capitol is of the utmost disgrace. We are a nation governed by the rule of law, and our democracy is built upon the fundamental principle of majority rule. The president's actions and words today will forever live in infamy and cement his place in history as our nation's worst president.
Wow.
That's headlines, too.
Where is that headlines from? This one says Trump speaks to insurrectionists occupying the Capitol. I love you, right? He was encouraging after this whole event, he was encouraging people to think of themselves as very, very special indeed. And I believe that it was interpreted as an encouragement to them to continue with what they were doing.
Right. Well, some of the people have noted that the protesters, when they did storm the Capitol, did not hang a U.S. flag from the Capitol balcony. They instead hung a Trump flag. And what even the cable networks are beginning to focus upon is how exactly were these protesters able to storm the Capitol? Because certainly we have seen the Capitol Police in particular, but police across the country react pretty violently when Black Lives Matter protesters this summer were protesting the killing of civilians by the police in various parts of this country. There are videos that are now being circulated that actually show the police opening up the gates at the Capitol to allow the protesters to march in to the Capitol. And given that President Trump for 6 months has been egging on the militia to across the country to riot on January 6th, I don't think there was anybody in the United States who was not aware that was a large potential for violence today. The only exception apparently being the Capitol Police, who were woefully understaffed and it failed to line up sufficient backup, didn't even have, you know, medics on hand. And even though cable network news are saying, why were the Capitol Police so unprepared for this particular event?
Well, they certainly were. And I think there's a lot of discussion about what had specifically happened. I heard one opinion saying that they had no idea that this was going to be a violent protest, that they were leaving the position they had at the White House in a peaceful, calming way. But as they approached the Capitol, they became incited and caused a great deal of trouble. So yeah. Apparently there are some opinions that they were caught off guard.
Yes, they apparently didn't read like the press releases from what's that called? I want to say Pet Shop Boys, but it's not the Pet Shop Boys, but
Proud Boys,
Proud Boys, who said, we're going to be out there in force, but don't worry, we're not going to use our usual uniforms. We're going to dress up differently so that we'll blend in better to the crowd before we take action. But, you know, apparently that was on social media, but the Capitol Police must not monitor you know, the social media, but also less, you know, this, first of all, you have the whole problem. It's been more than 30 years since a Republican actually won the popular vote for president. I think probably it was Ronald Reagan, the last one who won the popular vote. Pretty all the Republicans who have elected president since then have lost the popular vote, but have been elected through the Electoral College, which was designed by our so-called founding fathers, many of whom were slave owners, to increase the power of the slave states so that, you know, in selecting the president, so that they would agree to, you know, join, you know, in creating the United States, you know, after the Revolutionary War. And many people argue that the Electoral College does do its job very well of preserving the power of the slave states. But I think you mentioned earlier, Andrea, that, you know, the president had filed more than 60 lawsuits.
Absolutely.
Challenging the legality of votes in places like Arizona and Michigan and Pennsylvania. All 60 had been thrown out by the courts, many being thrown out by Republican judges. But yet there were 11 senators and 100 congressmen who is still planning to challenge the election results today, even though after, I guess, a month of alleging, you know, voter fraud, they've not been able to produce a single case. But the idea that a president can openly call for a coup and the police stand by to allow that to occur, and, you know, so many Republican elected officials openly support that coup. In fact, the Albany Republicans actually sent down a busload of people to D.C. today. I think it's very frightening for our democracy here in the United States. And we only have about a minute or two left. So, Andrea, are there any other particular headlines that you thought were noteworthy?
Well, what I thought was really tragic is someone was indeed shot and injured in the Capitol during this whole fiasco. And also the other thing that I thought was interesting was that the mayor of D.C. had asked for the National Guard to come in. And 15 minutes later, you get a tweet from President Trump, who was saying that he had ordered the National Guard to come in. So those sort of dichotomies really stick in my brain a little bit.
Well, apparently the Virginia governor, I guess maybe he's a Democrat, he did eventually order the National Guard to come in. So this is certainly a day of infamy in American history. America, you know, joins banana Republicans across the planet, where, you know, election results are, you know, sought to be overturned by the rich on the powerful, and we will certainly have the storming of the Capitol be front page photos on newspapers across the planet. But we're going to turn to our first story, which surprisingly follows up a bit on this. As we noted earlier, on Tuesday in Georgia, the Democrats took control of the United States Senate by narrowly winning the two runoffs for the United States Senate. And we talked with Greg Palast, who's an investigative reporter, about how the election would not have been even as close as it was if state officials had not purged nearly 200,000 residents from the voting rolls. We're talking with Greg Palast, an investigative reporter we had on a few weeks ago, discussing his book, How Trump Stole 2020. Yesterday, of course, was the election for the two Senate seats in Georgia. It appears as if the two Democrats have narrowly won those seats, given the control of the Senate to the Democrats. But there's a lot of indication that that election should not have been so close, because several hundred thousand Georgia voters were denied the right to vote. So, Greg, can you discuss a little bit of some of the problems you've seen down there in Georgia? I understand you were down in Atlanta yourself.
And if you go to gregpalast.com, you can see my the video of my investigation. In fact, I sued the state to return 198,351 voters to the voter rolls who were illegally removed. You have no idea. The Jim Crow operation here, it's like 1954. And, you know, the U.S. media was playing up the Secretary of State and the governor is standing up to Donald Trump and they're heroic. No, they aren't. They were trying to steal the Senate race, and they couldn't do that and save Donald Trump at the same time. There were, and again, 198,351 voters illegally removed from the voter rolls. They said they'd left Georgia. You'll love this. They said they left Georgia, but they didn't. That they didn't move out of the state. They're still here. I've got video of them in the homes where they still live, in Atlanta and Decatur and all over the state. What the state did was that, I don't know where they got this Jim Crow list of people that moved. It's suspiciously heavy on black voters and brown voters and Asian American voters. And so I literally, I worked with Black Voters Matter and Rainbow Push and Now Voto Latino, where we've sued the state to return these voters to the roll. Don't forget, this race ain't over. There's going to be a battle, especially in the Ossoff race, because it's going to easily be within a half percentage point difference between the candidate. That triggers an automatic recount. And they're going to do their damn best to do exactly what Trump had asked them to do, and they're very good at, which is to take ballots and disqualify them, throw them in the garbage. This is the game that they play. You know, one thing that the media doesn't report, they give these votes as if that's all the votes that were cast. I'm telling you right now, it's nonsense. We have tens of thousands of ballots which are just disqualified. They, because we have a massive mail-in vote, which is overwhelmingly a Democratic vote. I was at the polling stations where two people, I encountered three people about to put their ballots into the drop boxes, their absentee ballots, because people wisely this time did not go, you know, use the post office. But they didn't have their return addresses, two of the three people. Those ballots are going in the garbage can. You have to understand, that's how the games are played. It's a gotcha system. Oh, you didn't put on a return address? You're out of here. And if you put on a return address and you leave out your middle initial, but you registered with a middle initial, they get you. And they even had crazy, you know, this is just the beginning of the insane, crazy rules. They did, you know, they pulled tricks like, for example, Cobb County, which is part of Atlanta. There were 11 early voting stations in the general election. They were shocked when Biden slammed Cobb County. Cobb County is Newt Gingrich's old district. Newt Gingrich. Biden won it. So they panicked. They had 11 polling stations for 500,000 voters, that's all. And guess what? They cut the 11 to 5. And the 6 stations that they closed were all, every one, in the black neighborhoods of Cobb County. I mean, I could go on for literally Well, I could write a book. I have.
Right. Now, anyway, you know, watching your video, one of the people you ran into early on during your investigation in Atlanta was Stacey Abrams, who at that point, I guess, was the majority leader in the Senate. She seems like somebody who really did stand up to try to fight for voter rights.
Yeah, and they savaged her. In fact, when I issued my, I issued a report for the ACLU of Georgia saying 100, you know, identifying, when we say 198,351 voters, you can tell by the exact number, almost 200,000 voters are removed. We're not guessing. We checked the addresses of every one of these people with the United States Post Office. And by the way, that, you know, if someone left the state, the post office would know. And it's not just smart or a good idea to check with the post office. It's the federal freaking law, okay? And they violated the federal law to remove voters they didn't like. By the way, in that group, we include Martin Luther King's 94-year-old cousin who was removed from the voter rolls as if she'd left Atlanta. And I went to her home in Atlanta. She ain't moved nowhere. These are the games. And Stacey Abrams was the first person. So Stacey Abrams, who was cheated out of the governorship in 2018, she cited my work saying, look, this is what they did to me based on the work, the investigation of Greg Palast, which has now been issued by the ACLU. And we even sued them now. We're in federal court trying to get these voters back on. We got a lot back on already. And if we hadn't put 30, 40,000 people back on the voter rolls that were on that purge list, we contacted them by phone, by postcard, by billboards, by PSAs. You have no idea. To try to get legitimate voters back on. This is, by the way, I didn't ask people's registration. I made a big point. I don't want to know their registration. These are voters. These are Americans. And so I put Stacey Abrams on the air. This is a 7-year investigation. I put Stacey Abrams on the air. The first time she was ever on national television was with me in 2014. And the same with the minister at the Ebenezer Baptist Church, a guy named Raphael Warnock. He'd never been on national TV. So I put both of them on national TV. And you know, the rest is history. But history ain't over.
So what can we do to prevent this type of, you know, voter theft, voter suppression moving forward?
What we've always done. This is a battle that's, what, 4 centuries long to get the right to vote. You have to understand there's a long march, and that march ain't done. In the Revolutionary War, a guy named George Washington, with his buddy Thomas Jefferson, fought for the right to vote for Jewish voters, which is a big issue in America. Jews couldn't vote in a lot of states like Virginia, their own states. And that's where the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, not Second Amendment, comes from. The First Amendment comes from is this battle to allow Jews to vote and also Catholics, because you had to take an oath in many states to that, an oath that you swear to the Lord Jesus, that knocked out the Jews and had no foreign allegiance. And that was read as, if you were Catholic, that you were, that your allegiance was to the Pope. So you couldn't vote. This is a long battle. The American Indian population, the native indigenous population, didn't get the vote until in Arizona until what? 1947. Like that? Actually, Catholics in North Carolina got the vote after about 2 years after African Americans got the vote after the Civil War. This isn't over. We're not even close to over. Here in Georgia, one of the biggest attacks on voters is the attack on the Asian American population. The current governor, who was Secretary of State in charge of the vote, Brian Kemp, he shut down through legal threats, through intimidation, the group 10,000 Koreans vote. He didn't want 10,000 Koreans to vote. You know why? It's not that they're not the old style Jim Crow racists wearing white hoods. They don't use white sheets anymore to scare away voters of color. these spreadsheets. It's very sophisticated. That's why I'm actually, one of the reasons I'm here is that I have a federal court appearance. I've sued these guys in federal court to change these rules, to get these voters back on the roll. And just yesterday filed a new legal action because they're going to try to disqualify a lot of ballots.
So Greg, we're out of time. People want to find out more information. Your website?
Go to gregpalast.com. That's GREGPALAST, gregpalast.com. This battle ain't over. Sign up, get the info, and stay vigilant, stay tuned. And the battle for Georgia has just begun.
Okay. And this has been Greg Palast. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And that was Mark. He interviewed Greg Palast last month about his book, How Trump Stole 2000. You can find the interview on our podcast at mediasanctuary.org. And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe. And with me is Mark Dunley. So if you're listening,
Mark Dunley, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy and WOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady. And I should mention a typo. It's actually How Trump Stole 2020. But we are coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
And to learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. So for our next segment, World Beyond War seeks to convince governments and institutions to divest from the war machine. They also want to close military bases. Well, we speak here with Greta Zaro, Organizing Director of World Beyond War.
We're talking with Greta Zaro, who is the Organizing Director of World Beyond War. Greta, why don't we just start off with a brief introduction to, you know, what is World Beyond War?
Thanks for having me, Mark. World Beyond War is a global grassroots network. We have members in 188 countries worldwide that have signed our Declaration of Peace, advocating for the end to all war and the transition to a just and sustainable peace. And we look at war holistically, looking to abolish the entire institution of war and looking at all of its multifaceted impacts, from the environmental impact to the economic impact, of course, the human impact. And you can learn all about our mission and campaigns at worldbeyondwar.org.
Now, recently, I was involved in a campaign. It took 8 years, but we successfully convinced the state controller in New York to finally divest the state pension funds from fossil fuel. But I see you, World Beyond War, has a campaign, divest from the war machine. So what are you trying to accomplish with that?
Yeah, that was so exciting to see that New York has finally divested its pension fund from fossil fuels. And we would call on the legislature and the comptroller to divest from weapons as well, which ties into our Divest from the War Machine campaign, which is really about exposing the pervasiveness of the war machine, weapons manufacturers, et cetera, in our society. And when we kind of look under the hood, and see that, unfortunately, a lot of the banks that we use and the places where we invest our retirement funds are then reinvesting that money in weapons manufacturers. And so the campaign is about, you know, looking at your investments on the personal level, but beyond that, also looking at it at the community level and institutional level, such as where churches put their endowments and universities put their endowments, all the way up to city investments and state investments.
Now, one of the campaigns I was looking at recently is Stop the Money Pipeline Going Back to Fossil Fuels. But, you know, they look at some of the big banks like J.P. Morgan Chase is, you know, $190 billion or something in fossil fuels over the last 5 years. What are some of the big investors in the war machine?
Yeah, some of the big ones that come to mind are Raytheon, General Dynamics, Honeywell, Boeing. There are so many. And also something that we really like to emphasize is the fact that You know, fossil fuels and weapons are intimately tied because wars are often fought for fossil fuels, and because war and preparations for war are one of the leading causes of pollution and climate change. The U.S. military is actually the largest institutional consumer of oil on the planet. So really, when we're talking about divestment about fossil fuels, we need to also incorporate divestment from weapons and make those linkages.
Another one of your campaign is close military bases. So we're talking about military bases in the United States or the, I don't know, hundreds of military bases worldwide that the United States maintains.
In an ideal world, we would like to see the closure of all military bases as we transition away from this notion of militarized security. But our campaign really focuses first and foremost on the closure of U.S. foreign military bases, which we see as kind of low-hanging fruit, as something that we could easily start to close these foreign bases, which really serve no purpose other than to just promote U.S. imperialism and expansionism and kind of promote U.S. dominance around the world. And, you know, even we oppose war from every country, but we do recognize that the U.S. military is the biggest culprit here and has 95% of all foreign military bases, which is something like 800 military bases in 80 countries.
Now, of course, we presumably have just elected, a new president. We'll see later in January whether the incumbent needs to be dragged out. But, how are you, what are you hoping to see, from the Biden administration on some of the issues that world beyond war? You know, do you have some top actions you're hoping to convince him to take?
Yeah, one action that we're pushing is to avoid war with Iran and to re-sign the nuclear deal, which is something that Trump pulled out of. So that would be one step that can be taken right away with the new Biden administration. And another top action on day one is to stop supporting the war on Yemen. It was unbelievable, actually, that Congress twice passed legislation to end U.S. support for the war on Yemen, which was very historic. And then when that legislation got to Trump's desk, he actually vetoed it twice. And so we're hopeful that Congress can again pass that and that Biden would sign it and we can finally pull out of that horrible, horrible war.
Now, Dwight Eisenhower, who led the American and I guess allied forces in World War II and, was president for two terms, he did warn the country as he departed about the military, industrial, congressional, complex, which still seems to have a lot of power in D.C. How can we as citizens, sort of challenge the domination that the military industrial complex has, over the purse strings and over Congress?
Yeah, that ties into the Divest from the War Machine Coalition's work, which is a national coalition working on this issue. And one of the campaigns related to divestment is to call on our elected officials as well to stop taking money from weapons manufacturers. So that is part of the campaign to expose, which members of Congress are receiving money from the weapons manufacturers and to call on them to stop doing that. And I think, also just in general, working on divestment helps to reveal these connections in our society and helps to stigmatize the war machine and show, as you're saying, that this complex is pervasive and existing all throughout society.
So what can, the average American, do at this point, and how can people sort of best engage with World Beyond War?
Yeah, I would encourage folks to go to our website, worldbeyondwar.org, and the first step is to sign the Declaration of Peace that I mentioned at the beginning, which is really a pledge to commit to working with us nonviolently to end all war. Take that pledge. When you sign it, you can check boxes to say what you're interested in, whether it's closing bases or divestment or something else, and then we'll follow up with you to take action on your interest areas.
One of the concerns that many activists has that even though, while the Democrats claim that the Russians, helped elect Mr. Trump as president, the tensions with Russia certainly increased over the last 4 years. And certainly both Trump and Obama was increasing tensions with China. So what should we be doing in terms of trying to, you know, diffuse the Cold War, you know, with China and Russia at this point?
Yeah, we think that it's very important for the U.S. to be a leader in leading demilitarization and disarmament efforts. As you said, that there's all of this talk and demonizing of these other countries. But again, when we look at the numbers, we see that the U.S. is, you know, far and away the largest culprit here with, as we mentioned, 95% of all foreign military bases, 50% of all military spending, which is $1 trillion a year, is from the U.S. military. So really, we have to see who is the elephant in the room. It's the U.S. And so we envision if the U.S. can lead the way in disarmament, other countries will follow. Because right now, as we're continuing to escalate, that's just threatening these other countries and then causing this kind of arms race where they're, you know, arming up in fear of what we could do.
So we have about a minute left. One thing the Obama administration did that many people are not familiar with is that I think it's almost $1 trillion they committed to upgrading, you know, our nuclear weapon arsenal, which sort of ratchets up the threat of nuclear war. So in 45 seconds, what can we do to defuse the threat of nuclear war?
Yeah, I would again urge people to look at divestment. It's a really tangible way to take action. Look at where you are banking, where you're putting your investments, and start lifting the hood of the institutions in your communities, universities, churches, etc. Look at where they invest and divest from the war machine. That's something that's so tangible, and we have agency to do that.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Greta Szarrow, the organizing director of World Beyond War, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio. You can tune in every Wednesday for our Peace Bucket segment.
And for our next segment, this is part one of a three-part interview with Assemblymember John McDonald. Corrine Carey offers the environmental concerns raised by the Cohoes-based incineration plant, that's Norlite, and policing reforms and marijuana legislation in New York.
Assemblymember, thank you so much for joining me.
It's good to be with you, and Happy New Year to you and all the listeners.
You had some notable successes in 2020. Our listeners were very concerned about the Norlite incinerator and the hazardous chemicals that were being burned there. And you shepherded a bill through that was recently signed by the governor to prohibit the burning of some of those chemicals. Can you talk about that victory?
Yeah, so, you know, what an interesting dynamic. And, you know, as much as we'd like to comment how government can be slow at times, thanks to the work and effort of a lot of individuals, both advocates, the local government, City of Cohoes, my partner at the center, Senator Breslin, and eventually Governor Cuomo, we were able to shepherd this bill through in a pretty quick pace in a disjointed year. You know, what started on Valentine's Day, I remember Bill Keeler calling me, the mayor, saying, I got to talk to you about something that's going on. It wasn't a Valentine by any stretch of the imagination. And by June, all right, and don't forget, we did not meet through much of April or May. We only had two meetings pretty much after the budget. We were able to put a bill in place that prohibited the burning of the AFFF, the firefighting foam material, at Norlite. And we got what most people didn't think we were going to get. We got a total outright ban. There was talk about making it statewide. The governor finally, after months of advocacy from a lot of folks, starting with the neighborhood right down there at Saratoga Street. I know your organization and many other environmental advocates were involved in sharing the information. We were able to get it done. The governor actually, in his signing of the bill, talked about the fact that, in effect, when it comes to New York State, this also serves as a statewide ban. And, you know, we do need to find a proper, safe way to dispose of these PFAS materials. There's no doubt about that. But we can't do that at risk to the public health. And it doesn't always mean incineration is going to be the answer.
I mean, there's more to be done on Norlite, though. Are you going to be participating in those efforts?
Yeah, I've actually been participating in the public meetings that have been going on. You know, I don't want to say work with, but I guess I would say work with, dealt with responded to Norlight for over 21 years now, formerly 13 years as mayor of the city of Cohoes, and now 8 years in the assembly. And it's a very intriguing place. It's very challenging. There's a lot of impact for the neighborhood, but there's impacts region-wide, and we really need to, no pun intended, hold our feet to the fire on accountability here in regards to what is truly going on there. Public's not aware. They've put in about a $30 million improvement there that technically should be a major improvement, but, you know, like anything else, we need to go through the process of the permit and review it and make sure that they're going to be accountable. They've had a history where they've had violations, some at DEC, some at the EPA. That's concerning. We have a lot of work to do with Norlight as their permit renewal is up, and I will truly be engaged.
What are some of the other things, aside from the coronavirus pandemic, that marked 2020 for you?
Where do you begin? You know, obviously criminal justice, the George Floyd. I don't want to say incident because it minimizes it. It's not an incident. Whatever it was horrific. And the only good thing is it finally moved everybody to say, wait a minute, we've been talking about this for years. We got to do something different. And, you know, once again, the Assembly and the Senate met in special session in late May and passed a major reform package. You know, I was a former mayor, but I was also the public safety commissioner at the time in the city of Cohoes. So I was very familiar with the complaints that members of the public had. I very much had concerns and knew what officers went through. And the fact that officers' disciplinary records were not available, it's always been a controversial topic, and I can see both sides, but at the end of the day, it needed to be changed. And we did change it. And I stand by my vote on that because I do think the majority of police officers that we engage with on a regular basis do their job and do it right. There is always going to be a small percentage where there's problems. And to be honest with you, in some circumstances, the problems that they have are not because of who they were when they were hired. Sometimes it basically evolves over the course of the job. It's not easy to be a law enforcement officer, and it's not easy to be, you know, a young black or brown man or woman in neighborhoods these days. So we've got to try to strike the balance, and I think that's what we did. It's been very, very challenging year for everybody. And our volume of case calls when it came to unemployment, when it came to, you know, can I go back to work? Can I reopen my business? How do I reopen my business? What can I do to get the PPP loan? All those type of things. It was kind of funny. I've said this a couple of times. I said, it's almost as if my career running a business and being in government for the last 20 years prepared me for this moment, because we were able to really dispense with a lot of matters for residents and businesses that got them going. And I was very pleased to be able to do that. And now we're dealing with the latest. You know, we have tenants who are afraid of eviction. We have small landlords, the ones who provide some of these properties, that usually it's marginal whether the landlord's going to make a buck. It's marginal whether the tenant's going to pay their rent. We have landlords who have tenants that have been now since the fall of 2019 haven't paid rent. They're struggling. This past week, I supported legislation that basically puts off any evictions until May. We recognize that during the winter, as we're seeing numbers skyrocketing throughout the capital region in number of cases, that we can't be having Corrine evicted from her apartment and then, boom, she goes and starts to, you know, move into some friends or relatives' residence, where you're adding more people to a residence where it's going to increase the potential for the virus to grow. So it's a tough situation for the tenants. It's a very difficult situation for some small landlords. The good news is there is aid out there, $60 million of the $100 million originally allocated has been pushed out the door this last week, where people can apply till February 1st. To get some support for up to 3 months of rent, which is important. And then $1.3 billion was approved in the latest federal stimulus package. And we are starting to tear into that right now to see how we can help push this money out the doors. Tenants should not have to be living worried about an eventual eviction. And on the same token, we don't want landlords to walk away from some of these properties, because at the end of the day, if we don't help the tenants meet their obligations and help at least keep these small landlords solvent, these corporate land entities are just going to come in and swoop up the properties. And it's something that we will regret 5 to 10 years down the road. Tough situation.
Tough situation all around, and the state budget is another tough situation. One of the measures that advocates are saying will help boost the state's finances is legalizing marijuana. I want to talk to you as an assembly member, but you're also a pharmacist. And yep. So I want to talk to you about your thoughts about legalizing adult use cannabis.
I do think that legalization is going to happen. I support it. You know, I was one of the main co-sponsors originally of the medical marijuana. Initially, I was a little bit leery about jumping right to legalization because I wanted to see how the medical marijuana rolled out. But the time has come. I mean, the reality is we're surrounded by every state. So folks are going to get it one way or the other. Shouldn't we look at this as our prohibition moment and look at this as an opportunity to say, okay, you know what? Maybe personally, I don't choose to ingest marijuana, but others do. And wouldn't it be best if we could implement a program in such a way that it actually snuffs out, for lack of a better term, the street dealer who doesn't really follow any quality control? Because I think part of the challenge, and this has been the riddle with these drugs made on the streets, there's no consistency. One of the major concerns I have is that the marijuana that's on the streets this day and age is being laced with fentanyl and has been a driving force for these deaths. So, you know, I do think it's going to happen. I want to caution folks, though, be very clear. Do not expect one red penny to come into the state of New York in this budget year and probably next year. It's going to take a good 18 months before this program is up and running. And I don't want anyone to think that I'm supporting it because it's going to solve our immediate budget concerns, because it's not going to. And we also have to be very thoughtful about how we, one, go about taxing that product, but also how we distribute those revenues when they do come up. If you put seven different layers of taxes on it and we still find that we're 100% above the street value market, we've got a problem on our hands. Don't get me wrong, people will pay premium price for quality product that they know is going to be consistent and it's going to keep them alive. But then we also have to be talking about the fact that many neighborhoods and cities are a good example, particularly in Troy and Albany. The neighborhoods have been ravaged by the Rockefeller drug laws that were established decades ago, but have had a very long impact and negative impact on the community and the people who have lived there. There is a very strong argument that our House has been saying that that money needs to be reinvested into those neighborhoods and into those communities that were impacted.
So you can tune in Thursday and Friday for segments 2 and 3 of the interview with the Assemblymember John McDonald. And I noticed that Governor Cuomo did put out his marijuana legalization proposal on Wednesday.
So Troy's last waterfront forest will be preserved as an ecological and cultural heritage site if local organizers and indigenous leaders can save it from a development proposed by Troy's Kevin Vandenberg. Vandenberg is seeking a rezoning to allow multi-unit housing on the 11.5-acre parcel, 10 of which lie in Troy's Lansingburg neighborhood and 1.5 acres in neighboring Pleasantdale. A runoff hearing before the Troy Planning Commission could be scheduled as soon as January 28th. HMM's Alexis Goldsmith speaks with Jess Bennett of Friends of the Mohicantuck.
We welcome again to the show Jess Bennett of Friends of the Mohicantuck to discuss 1011 Second Avenue in Lansingburg. Welcome back, Jess.
Thank you. Thanks for talking today.
So the Planning Commission for the City of Troy held a hearing on December 29th on the property. Can you tell us how that meeting went?
So the meeting, I consider an overall success. We had 60 people log on to the Zoom meeting, many of whom gave public comment. Once again, there was 100% public opposition to this project. But what I consider most a success is that by the end of it, the developer, Kevin Vandenberg, and his engineer, Jamie Easton, have agreed to start the environmental assessment form, which essentially initiates the seeker process, which is what we were really hoping for. And I consider that a really wonderful thing.
So for those who may not be yet familiar with this issue, can you just give us a quick overview of Kevin Vandenberg and what he's proposing at 1011 Second Avenue and why you were advocating for a CEQA process?
So the land at 1011 Second Avenue has a long and detailed history, but what we do know for certain through many archaeological surveys is that this has been used as a quarry for Indigenous people for quite literally thousands of years. It was part of the original Stone Arabia patent, which basically is the foundation of Troy and Lansingburg, and has been used as a community access point for the residents of Troy to the Hudson River for, you know, the last 200 years. It's also home to the last waterfront forest within the city of Troy. Kevin Vandenberg is a local developer by his admission. He's born and raised in Lansingburg and has done the majority of his projects in Troy. And he has approached the current owner of the property and would like to put a 240-unit apartment complex. And if they are unable to do that, and they are seeking a rezone of this parcel through the city process that we're kind of talking about now, then by right, they are saying that they will put a 36 single family planned development in. And I quote, they will knock down every single tree on the site if they are going to proceed with that plan. And so Friends of the Mohican Talk came together in this year, in 2020, and we are standing in opposition to this. And we want to see this land preserved for future generations of Troy and honor the Indigenous history of this land.
So can you talk a bit about the community organizing that has, as you just said, come together behind this issue and how you want to see the land preserved?
Friends of the Mohican Tech is a pretty broad coalition. It's community members, it's environmentalists, it's Troy residents who are concerned, and we are lucky to be working under the guidance and consultation of the Skodokoke First Nations. And right now, our priority is just seeing this development stopped and preserving the land. And that can be a lot of different things, whether it becomes a park or it gets put into trust by one of the many land preservation groups that we have in the Hudson Valley. You know, there are a variety of things we can do that maintains this, maintains its ecological sensitivity, and also makes it accessible to people and for future generations of people to enjoy. But right now, kind of step one is holding the city accountable as far as following New York State processes, which are the environmental assessment form, which triggers the CEQA process, which is the state environmental quality review. And that's something that every building or proposal of 200 units or higher, immediately this gets triggered and they have to go through this process. And that looks at many different avenues. It's run by the DEC, but there are many different state agencies get involved, and things that range from the archaeological sensitivity and significance that this particular piece of land is in what the DEC designates an environmental justice area, pollution, stormwater runoff, so many things that the state has really excellent processes in place to examine. And the reason we want this to be triggered within the city is because we want that examination to look at this land.
Can you talk about the significance of this land as Troy's last waterfront forest in terms of the climate crisis?
Certainly. We know that trees are not just good for the environment because of the oxygen that they produce, the carbon sequestration aspect of it, but it's things that we're not immediately thinking of with the climate crisis. Like when you have a forest in your community, it actually helps to bring down and regulate the temperature the moisture in the air, certainly things like it's a host to biodiversity, animals, birds, bats. We're actually working with an ecologist that has identified some rare species, rare to Rensselaer County, but also a potential moth, I believe, is a species that's globally rare. And this area, this forest at the northern border of the city of Troy can act as a sponge, if you will, or a buffer to the rising tides of climate change. And we're no stranger at this point to extreme weather. It was 60 degrees on Christmas Day, and I walked over to the land, and the water was probably up about 4 or 5 feet. And so right there, to me, that's a glaringly obvious example of how we need areas like this on the Hudson as a waterfront community to strengthen our defenses against climate change.
Can you talk about the indigenous groups that have a cultural ties to this piece of land?
There are numbers of indigenous groups that have cultural ties to this land. I mean, it's been used as a flint mine for, you know, up to, I think, 3000 BC is one of the archaeological reports that we have. And we're working with the Skodokoke First Nations. We do know that the Lenni Lenape, the Stockbridge Munsee, a number of Algonquin-speaking Native people throughout the years have no doubt all visited, lived on, used this land. And so in this era of elevating Indigenous voices and Black Lives Matter, we really think it's important for the city of Troy to honor Native land and not pave over it, essentially.
Can you talk about how the process has been of Kevin Vandenberg requesting this rezone to allow for apartments to be built on the site? How has this process been handled by the city? Because Friends of the Mohicantuck has been very critical about that.
We consider the city to be handling this rather poorly, to be honest. So what the city's doing is asking the Planning Commission right now to make a recommendation on a rezone of this parcel. First and foremost, this is not something that you can do independently of any other process. There are no formally filed plans, so you can't just look at this as a rezone. We don't want the city to give the developer what's essentially a blank check, and suddenly there's a planned community rezone for this land. He can turn around and sell it because now it's worth three times or more. We want to know what the actual plans are and then go through the SECR process, using that as our guide. The city currently is saying, well, this is just a rezone. But then the month before, in November, the developer gave a workshop to the Planning Commission with actual plans and a backup set of plans. The environmental assessment form, so essentially the whole SECR process, the very first workbook page you look at, it deals with zoning. So that the city is looking at this as a kind of a segmented matter. It makes me think that they must think the people of Troy are stupid. Like, we can see right through this. And we urge the city of Troy to go through this SECR process and see this through to the end, because that's what it's here for. It's to protect our land, the citizens, the neighborhood.
Jess, in the last 30 seconds, what's the next step of the process and how can people get involved?
What we urge people to do is write their elected city officials, your state officials, Congress people, and let them know where you stand on this. We also have a legal defense fund. We anticipate that we're going to need to take some legal action in the future. And what this does is set up to take immediate action as soon as it's needed. Check out our website, save1011.org. Sign up for our action alert newsletters. Tell your friends, get involved. And if you can and feel so moved, please donate. Thank you.
This has been Jess Bennett of Friends of the Mohican Tuck. This has been Jess Bennett of Friends of the Mohican Tuck. Thank you so much for joining us, Jess.
Thank you, Alexis.
So a hearing before the Troy Planning Commission could be scheduled as soon as January 28th. We'll continue to follow this story. This concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. And thank you to our engineer at Siena, Basila Hickey. Remember to join in or to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
The Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. You can join by shooting us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly Zoom meetings Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. By sending a request to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thanks for tuning in.